Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're really getting into some intense material. It's the survival playbook for emergency medical services personnel. High stakes stuff.
It really is. I mean, people often don't realize that EMS is a profoundly dangerous job. We're looking at protocols based on medics getting seriously hurt or even killed, just doing their jobs, trying to help people.
Yeah, it's sobering. So the sources we're diving into today, they aren't just about medical procedures, are they?
Not at all. This is about tactical awareness, self-preservation. It's the unique skill set needed to navigate and survive potentially violent situations.
Right. So our mission for you, the listener, is to really grasp the discipline involved, how these professionals manage active threats, spot danger signs, protect themselves, and crucially handle that dual role, saving a life while also preserving a potential crime scene.
And that dual mission kicks in from the very start. The core safety idea is pretty stark. Recognize violence, get out, find safety, wait for law enforcement. Simple as that sounds.
But crucial, if a scene feels off, even slightly unsafe on arrival,
then you stop. You must call for law enforcement to secure it. You don't go in. That assessment starts the second you get the dispatch information, really.
That initial check is so vital. And something the materials highlight is this issue of mistaken identity.
Yeah, tragically. Paramedics can be mistaken for police officers, and that alone can trigger unintentional violence against them.
So the recommendation is clear uniforms, highly identifiable.
Exactly. Visibility helps prevent that deadly confusion. It's a proactive step.
And beyond uniforms, personal prep, body armor comes up.
Definitely. You need to know what type of armor your service provides, and this is key, make sure it fits correctly. A poorly fitting vest isn't just less effective, it can actually restrict your movement when you need it most.
Right. Preparation isn't passive. It's about having the right gear ready to go.
Okay, so let's shift to recognizing those danger signs. How do they train people for this? It's more than just seeing a weapon, I assume.
Oh, much more. It's about constant situational awareness, looking for those precursors to violence.
Things like abnormal behavior, right?
Yeah.
Specific body language, defensive stances, maybe aggressive posturing, even the language being used, if it's harsh or escalating quickly.
It sounds like part behavioral science, part street smarts.
That's a good way to put it. And this is where standard operating procedures, the SOPs, are absolutely vital.
They form the backbone, the guidelines say.
Yeah. Every approach, every decision in a potentially volatile situation should ideally be grounded in those pre-planned SOPs for your agency or region. It helps minimize guesswork in a crisis.
Reduces the cognitive load, I guess. So if you do perceive danger, the SOP says, retreat, back away safely, call for help.
Right, but it's not just running away. Even as you retreat, you're expected to gather critical intel.
That seems incredibly difficult, processing a threat and observing details.
It is. The sources list exactly what dispatch needs. Your unit ID, location where the injured person is, estimated number of attackers, types of injuries, any weapon seen, and if a vehicle is involved in leaving the scene, make, model, color, license plate if possible, direction of travel, all while potentially being under threat.
That really underscores the discipline needed. You're a medic, but you're also law enforcement's eyes and ears in those first moments.
Absolutely. Okay, should we move into some tactical specifics? Motor vehicle incidents, for instance. Highways are particularly nasty.
Yeah, the triple threat, they call it. You've got potentially violent patients, you've got moving traffic whizzing by, and then distracted drivers rubbernecking.
Exactly. And the positioning of the EMS vehicle is incredibly specific, almost like choreography. For a single vehicle crash.
They say stop 21 feet behind the involved vehicle. That precise.
21 feet, yes. It sounds arbitrary, but that precision creates a standard. It builds muscle memory, sets a consistent safety zone, and dictates approach retreat distances without having to think too hard under stress.
And the angle? 45 degrees.
45 degrees, driver's side pointing towards the center of the road. And turn the front wheels left.
Okay, let's break that down. The angle creates protective barrier with the ambulance, right? And the wheels turned left means you're angled to pull away safely into traffic if needed.
Precisely. It's all pre-planned safety. They also stress using high beams, spotlights, really illuminating the patient's vehicle. Light up the scene.
But even with all that, the golden rule applies.
Always. Okay. If you have any uneasy feeling, you don't approach. Trust your gut. Wait for backup.
Okay, so assuming the crew feels it's safe to approach, it's usually a two-person crew, what's the next step, the actual approach path?
Right, the person in the right front seat, the passenger side, takes the lead. They walk towards the rear passenger side trunk area first.
Why there?
Check the trunk lid is closed and secured. No surprises from back there. Then move cautiously up to the C-post. That's the pillar behind the rear passenger window.
And stop there.
Yes. Stop. Look through the rear window, the side window. Scan the back seat. Only if that back seat is empty do you move forward to the B-post, the pillar between the front and rear doors.
So it's a very deliberate, slice-the-pie kind of approach, checking blind spots incrementally.
Exactly. Maximize your view before committing closer to the driver or front passenger. And you only announce yourself after you've assessed it safe. Tap the window, identify yourself. Follow your SOPs.
What about flashlights? Seems obvious, but is there a technique?
There is. Keep it off until you actually need it. When you use it, hold it at arm's length, away from your body.
Ah, so the light source isn't directly tied to your center mass.
Right. Illuminate briefly, then switch it off or move. Don't give anyone a fixed target.
Makes sense. What about larger vehicles? Vans, specifically, they offer more concealment.
Yeah, special precautions there. You need more distance. Stay about 10 to 15 feet away from the passenger side. Critically, stay clear of that sliding side door that's a huge danger zone.
Right, someone could burst out.
Exactly. So you walk parallel to the van, staying back, until you're about 45 degrees forward of the A-post, the pillar by the windshield. You want to view the interior from an offset slightly forward angle, not directly side on.
Okay, that calculated approach on roads makes sense. But what about residential calls? Behind closed doors, confined spaces. That feels even more unpredictable.
It often is. And the number one rule, hammered home in the sources. If the call involves violence, domestic dispute, assault reported law enforcement must secure the scene before EMS even thinks about going in, period.
And even once inside, you're constantly reevaluating.
Constantly. The situation can change in a heartbeat. When first arriving, if Ellie isn't there yet, only one person approaches the door initially.
The solo scout, what are they looking for? Listening for?
Listening for loud voices, threats, sounds of a struggle. Glancing in windows if possible, looking for anything suspicious, weapons, signs of chaos. If anything feels wrong, you back away. Back in the vehicle, call for Ellie, wait.
And if they do knock, there's even a tactic for where to stand.
Yes, pure tactical positioning, minimizing exposure. If the door opens inward, you stand on the doorknob side.
So the door opens away from you.
Right. If it opens outward, you stand on the hinge side.
So the door opens towards you, acting as a potential shield.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Using the door itself as cover.
Smart. Okay, so you get inside, then what? Managing the scene.
Right. Ask the person who answered the door to lead you to the patient. Ask them to turn on lights as you go. Secure any pets. That's a big one. Turn off TVs, radios, anything loud and distracting.
Creating a calmer, more controlled environment.
Ideally. And if the patient is in a really chaotic or unsafe spot, the materials advise trying to move them, if feasible, to somewhere brighter, quieter, or just safer within the residence.
And escape routes.
Non-negotiable. The second you enter any structure, you mentally identify a primary exit and a secondary exit, and you try hard to keep at least one of those routes clear and accessible at all times. You need a way out.
Especially in domestic violence situations, the sources mention a specific technique, contact and cover.
Yes, very important, especially when things are tense but maybe not overtly violent at that moment. It splits the crew's focus for safety.
How does that work?
One paramedic is the contact. Their job is solely focused on the patient. Talking to them, assessing them, starting care, making that direct connection.
Okay, so one is hands-on.
Right. The second paramedic is the cover. Their main job isn't direct patient care initially. They're responsible for getting other information, maybe from family members, but more importantly, they are scanning the entire scene, watching everyone else in the room, gauging the tension level, looking for warning signs, watching hands, potential weapons. They're the safety officer, essentially.
Providing that crucial overwatch while the other medic works. Makes sense. Okay, section 3 in our sources gets into some really extreme environments. Starts with clandestine drug labs, meth labs specifically.
Yeah, unfortunately common. Methamphetamine is the big one. And the chemicals used are incredibly dangerous, highly flammable, toxic, explosive sometimes.
And these aren't always in buildings, right?
Yeah, well, that's a key point. Vehicles, cars, vans, RVs can be mobile meth labs. So the danger isn't just the people involved. It's the environment itself, the air, the surfaces.
Protocol is strict then.
Absolutely. Stay clear until hazmat or law enforcement secures it. If you have to extricate a patient before it's fully cleared, you do it only if you can avoid contaminating yourself. The toxicity risk is huge.
That contamination risk ties back to evidence preservation later, too, I imagine.
Definitely. Then there's gang activity. The material notes it's spreading beyond cities into suburban and rural areas, often tied to the drug trade.
The advice there seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah, know your area, talk to local law enforcement, find out about known gang territories or problem spots. Awareness is key.
And then, mass violence, active shooters, mass casualty incidents. These seem to be increasing, tragically.
They are, and they present unique challenges. These events can be protracted, like a standoff, or dynamic and constantly moving, and they completely change medical priorities.
How so? Triage changes.
Fundamentally, patient care priority shifts. It's no longer just based on who is most critically injured. It's based on who is most critically injured in a safe location.
Wow. So you might have to bypass someone who needs help.
The sources are explicit. EMS may be directed to pass over salvageable patients if they are located in an unsecured hot zone. It's a brutal reality of tactical medicine.
That's where the rescue task force concept comes in.
Exactly. Small teams of EMS moving forward with law enforcement escorts into warm zones areas, cleared but not fully secured to deliver immediate life-saving interventions, mostly hemorrhage control, basic airway stuff, trying to minimize that time to treatment.
But the main treatment area, the staging area, that's kept far back.
Generally, yes. Triage, treatment, transport areas should be set up a good distance away, maybe half a mile to a mile, until the scene is absolutely confirmed secure by law enforcement.
And this requires joint training, EMS and police.
Essential. Training together on things like assessing an injured officer, how to safely remove their firearm if necessary, building that operational familiarity before a crisis. There's even guidance if an EMS provider is taken hostage. A terrifying thought.
What's the advice there?
Basically, keep a low profile. Don't attract attention. Avoid direct eye contact with captors. Remove identifying items, badges, pins, anything that marks you as official or authoritative. And if possible, offer to treat wounded people. It can sometimes build a sliver of rapport or at least show utility.
Okay, this next point feels absolutely fundamental for survival in a shooting. Cover versus concealment. Getting this wrong is fatal.
It's one of the most critical distinctions. Cover stops bullets. Concealment only hides you.
So give us examples. What's actual cover?
Think solid, dense objects. Large trees, concrete utility poles, those big metal mail collection boxes, dumpsters, especially if full, engine blocks of vehicles, significant depressions in the ground, curbs sometimes, brick walls, concrete walls, generally much better than cinder block.
And concealment,
right.
Things that just hide you.
Right. Tall grass, bushes, shrubbery, dark shadows. Critically, most interior walls in houses or buildings, they're just concealment.
Right.
Drywall won't stop much.
So the rule is, if law enforcement dives for cover, you dive for cover. Mimic them.
Absolutely. Get behind something solid. Conform your body to the shape of the cover. Make yourself as small a target as possible.
And moving between cover, only if necessary.
Only if the new spot is clearly better cover, ideally farther away from the threat, and you can get there without exposing yourself significantly, it's a calculated risk.
And you check first.
Always. Peek quickly from different heights, different angles around your cover, before you even think about moving. Quick looks, then back behind cover.
What about direct confrontation? If someone is blocking you from reaching a patient?
Verbal commands first. Identify yourself clearly.
Yeah.
Instruct them firmly to move. State clearly, I cannot help the patient if you are in the way. Avoid escalating with verbal threats yourself, though.
And if that doesn't work, or if the patient becomes aggressive during assessment?
If someone takes aggressive action, the advice is stark. Use distraction. Create a momentary disruption.
Like that.
Throw something lightweight. The sources suggest things like a roll of tape, maybe keys, aim for the face or nose area if possible. The goal isn't to injure, but to interrupt their thought process, their OD loop. Break their chain of action for just a second or two.
And in that second.
You turn, get out of the immediate line of fire or attack, and you run. Run towards your vehicle. Run to safety. Create distance immediately.
That moment of controlled chaos really highlights the danger, which brings us to that final critical challenge, preserving evidence, that dual mission again.
Right. Saving the life is priority one, but maintaining the integrity of the crime scene runs a very close second. Why? Because it directly impacts the chances of catching and convicting the person responsible for the violence.
So EMS deals with two main types of evidence.
Testimonial, which you personally saw, heard, smelled, were told, and real or physical evidence, objects, fluids, tracks, etc. The absolute golden rule for physical evidence is do not disturb it. Don't damage it. Don't move it. Don't alter it if you can possibly avoid it.
But sometimes you have to move things for patient care, right? Cutting clothes, for example.
Yeah, and there are protocols. When cutting clothing with trauma shears, you actively avoid cutting through bullet holes or knife tears. Cut along seams or in undamaged areas whenever possible.
Preserve the original damage.
Exactly. And never shake clothing out. You can dislodge tiny but crucial trace evidence. Hairs, fibers, gunpowder residue.
What about your own equipment?
Don't leave anything behind. No wrappers, no used supplies. Pack it in, pack it out. Your stuff can contaminate the scene.
And if you must move a piece of evidence to treat the patient, say a weapon lying on their chest.
Handle it as minimally as possible. And the procedure is specific. Each piece of evidence goes into its own separate brown paper bag. Paper allows items to breathe, preventing mold or degradation, especially if damp.
Brown paper bags. Got it. What if the item is soaked in blood or fluids?
Then, after it's in the paper bag, you can place that paper bag inside a plastic biohazard bag for safety and containment. But the item itself goes in paper first.
There's also the tough reality of futility, right? When life-saving efforts just aren't indicated.
Yes. There are clear medical situations where resuscitation efforts would be futile. In those cases, you must follow your local protocols, which often involve not starting CPR and basically freezing the scene as is. Don't get caught up in emotion and disturb things unnecessarily. Respect the scene as evidence.
Control contamination is key then.
Paramount. Limit the number of EMS personnel who actually enter the core crime scene. Every person leaves, traces DNA, fibers, don't clean things up, don't rearrange items to make things look tidier, don't move bodies unless absolutely necessary for accessing another living patient. Your main role, beyond immediate life threats, shifts to observation and documentation.
And that documentation, the written record, is vital.
Hugely important. Your report might be reviewed months, even years later. You might have to testify based on it. It needs to be accurate, objective, and detailed.
What needs to be included?
Basically everything. What you saw when you arrived, what you heard, statements, sounds, what anyone told you directly. Any distinct smells, chemicals, alcohol, gunpowder. Crucially, document anything you moved, altered, or disturbed, no matter how small. Note the chain of custody if you handled evidence who you gave it to. And provide a clear, objective description of the scene itself.
Wow. That's a lot to manage under pressure.
It truly is.
So wrapping this all up, what does this deep dive really tell us? I mean, the knowledge we've gone through today paints a picture of incredible professional discipline, doesn't it?
It really does. EMS personnel in these situations are performing this incredibly dangerous high wire act. They're balancing immediate critical medical care with this intense situational awareness and, layered on top, the strict rules of crime scene preservation.
It drives home that safety and collaborating with law enforcement aren't just side tasks. They're completely interwoven with providing effective medical care in these volatile environments.
Absolutely inseparable. And we talked specifically about that critical difference between cover things that actually stop bullets and concealment, things that just hide you.
Right. True protection versus just the appearance of safety.
Yeah.
So maybe the final thought for you, our listener, to take away is this. Think about how often, maybe even in your own daily life, professional or personal, you might confuse things that merely hide you from a problem or a risk with things that genuinely protect you from harm. That basic tactical distinction we discussed, cover versus concealment, it has life and death stakes on the job for these folks, but maybe there's a broader wisdom there. Applying that lens to how you observe your own environment, your own risks.
That's a powerful takeaway. Observe wisely and stay safe.
Until the next deep dive, stay safe and stay informed.